Professor of Psychiatry and author Brendan Kelly. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Brendan, we're going to talk about the stages of life today, but we're going to do it through the prism of the brain. And we'll be informed in this by recent new research into how our brain changes as we go through life. And there are some striking findings there. So we'll get into each stage in detail, but give me the overview first on this research and the four stages of brain development that identified.
So this is a piece of research from the University of Cambridge, published in a journal called Nature Communications, and it looks at almost 4,000 brain scans of people from all ages in life, from age zero right into the 90s. And it identifies four points across the life when there are particular changes in brain connectivity. At the age of 9 years, the age of 32, the age of 66, and then 83. So the brain changes through life. And what this research does is it takes a lot of brain scans and it tries to figure out what are the moments of, if you like, particularly significant change, and what do they tell us about the phases of life based on the brain and brain connectivity. So it's worth saying, you know, we are not just our brains. We got a whole lot of other stuff going on as well. So this research really looks at the brain only as part of how we develop through life.
Okay. So what's happening in the first transition around 8 or 9?
Well, when you're born, your brain is this extraordinarily complicated thing, and it remains complex. We have around 86 billion nerve cells in our brains, and they're connected up with each other. When you're born, there are many, many brain connections, and the first 9 years are spent consolidating some of those and letting some of the connections between brain cells go. It's whittling down. So a three-year-old has the most connected up complicated brain of any human being.
Okay.
At the age of 3 years.
Yeah.
And it's just too much. So what happens between 3 years and 9 years is there's a whittling down, and there's a focus on certain useful connections between nerve cells, and other ones are let go. So what this means in the first 9 years of life is the brain is in a sort of a use it or lose it situation, where children up to the age of 9 should be exposed to a lot of different things, so they retain a lot of different brain pathways. And that happens most intensively from the age of 3 years up until the age of 9 years.
Okay, and what does it tell us then about how we kind of parent or support kids who are around the age of 8 or 9 and starting to kind of make their brains more focused and efficient?
So what it tells us about parenting is that we need to give children the space and, if you like, the safety to test new things. You know, if I had one wish for all the children of the world,
yeah,
it would be for a stable upbringing where children feel able to try new things, experiment a little bit, satisfy that childish curiosity in a sense of safety so they can do new things and really enable those brain pathways to become strong at that point before they move into the next phase, which is between the age of 9 years and, amazingly, 32. There seems to be a very long adolescent type period in the brain.
So that next stage, just to acknowledge what you're saying there about that stability, so that we try and give our kids that safe space, that they can make the little sorties out into exploration, but that they always have a safe place to come back to and stability. So the next period then, the 9 to 32, does this suggest to us that people do not become adults until they are 32?
Well, I think we all know people who not only did not become adults at the age of 82, but never in fact became adults. And this research is interesting because it used to be believed that people tended to become adults in the early 20s. What this suggests is there's a similar kind of change going on in the brain up until around 32. And the brain is at its most internally connected and most powerful at the age of around 29 years or 30. So the brain will never be as connected up and functional for many people as it is towards the end of that period, around the age of 29 or 30.
Randomly, the weird thing about that is that David Bowie, who we were talking about there, for 10 years between 1970 and 1979, had this extraordinary flush of creativity. He was releasing one, sometimes two albums a year, all classics. Happened between the age of 23 and 33. And then that's regarded, after that, it's regarded as a different thing. But he had that decade of extraordinary creativity and output.
So that's a period of optimal brain function. We're thinking, using our cognitive skills better and in a more connected way than we probably ever will. Now, again, I have to...
But we're not fully matured, no?
No, we're getting there. We're getting there in terms of brain function. But, you know, maturity is not all about brain function. We're talking about how connected up the brain cells are here, but there are other things going on in the body as well as brain connections. So for example, what matters is not only how our brain is structured, but how we use it, you know, because brains vary in size and connectivity, and that doesn't always map onto productivity, genius, happiness, or even life satisfaction.
Okay.
Brain is important, but we are more than our brains.
And the environment we're operating in presumably has a big effect on that as well.
Our brain is part of our physical body, and very often we treat our physical body as a sort of a machine for carrying our brains around.
Yeah.
But in fact, our physical body shapes what our brain does as much as the other way around. So for example, if you're tired or if you're hungry, you'll notice this in your thoughts, or your thoughts might change a little bit. You might become a tiny bit irritable, annoyed, or difficult to get on with, and you won't really twig why this is until you realize you're hungry. So our brains are an integrated part of the body. They're connected with the rest of the body. So it's not just about brain function.
Okay. Should we cut people in their 20s a bit more slack in terms of expecting them to be like cooked properly by whatever, 18, 21 kind of thing?
Yeah, we should. We absolutely should. And we should cut teenagers and young adults a lot of slack for staying in bed as late as they do, because an awful lot of brain development happens while we're asleep.
Okay.
Brain cells are forming new connections, if you like. The brain is this extraordinary forest of pathways, each whispering to the neighbouring one. And those connections between brain pathways are laid down with particular intensity while we're asleep. The brain cells start kind of snuggling up to each other and connecting in new ways. And that's when real brain development happens.
This will be a comfort to a lot of people. So if we worry sometimes that a teenager has taken to the bed a bit too much, that's okay. It's normal.
There's a certain biological logic in that. Obviously, it gets incredibly annoying at a certain point, but it in fact makes sense. Sleep is a very important part of brain development. And this research tells us maybe that phase goes on longer than we might imagine. But if you're, you know, if you're at the age of 32, it probably is time to get out of bed now.
Get out of bed. Yeah. Okay. How does the brain rewire then around 32?
Well, around 32, we enter into this plateau phase, which goes on for more than three decades, which is it's a time when we get more set in our ways. It's a time when the connections that are formed become kind of consolidated, maybe a little compartmentalized. We start engaging in ritual behaviors, routine patterns. And this is a period of life where a lot of people can have a crisis, a midlife crisis. This is the midlife crisis period of life, these decades. And what's happening is there are fewer new connections being formed, but some of the old ones are getting stronger. We're getting set in our ways. Patterns are being established. We can still accomplish many things, of course, during this period. It's just not as innovative, perhaps, as the other periods are.
And explain to me, is there a compartmentalizing of the brain, is how you would describe it happening?
Yes, we're pruning the weak connections. So the connections we have already made, the things we're good at doing, we get better. And the stuff that we haven't been very good at doing, that gets pruned, or those brain connections aren't reinforced and they kind of are whittled away over time. The most important thing during this period is making sure our brains remain biologically healthy. And this means, well, one of the key things is ensuring our blood pressure is okay. And doing some physical activity. And, you know, through all of this, Brendan, if there is one magic bullet for brain health, it is physical activity, ensuring our brains have an adequate supply of oxygen and nutrients, that they can function well, grow well and be maintained.
OK, so how are we shaped between 32 and the next one, 66, by this kind of compartmentalization or staticness of the brain?
Well, what this means is there is a tendency for us to get stuck into our patterns, our personalities to remain unchanged during this period.
This is who I am. Yeah.
The path of least resistance. This is who I am. And change is more difficult. That being said, change is also worthwhile at this period. It just takes a little more effort. Our brains will be trying to plateau us, and we need to maybe try innovative or different things to challenge that process so that we continue to grow as individuals.
Okay. So in terms of that search for a bit of novelty, you know, you often hear, like, you know, try and be learning a language or do something different or whatever. What are practical ways we can kind of keep the brain evolving?
Yeah. So doing something different to what you're currently doing is the key here. So since most people aren't learning Mandarin or Japanese, then starting to do that is a good thing to do. If you like, it tickles your brain in a different way to the way you've been doing it up to now. So that is helpful. If, on the other hand, you have been learning many foreign languages, you need to start doing something different. A lot of apps and games claim that they improve brain function. Mm. To an extent, they do. But you'd be much better off to do something physically different to what you currently do.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's say it's walking or a bit of running or some weight training, or, you know, some small physical change will probably give you a lot more bang for your buck than some of the things that pop up on the phone as brain training mechanisms.
Really? So that it's firing different kind of connections and stuff, is it?
You need to fire different connections because you're going to get settled in your ways. And it's important we do this. It does keep our brains functioning better.
But actually physical activity fires things differently, more so than like doing Sudoku or whatever, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, doing Sudoku is good, particularly if you have not done it before.
Okay, I'm getting the message,
But physical activity can trump everything with the brain. So getting outside, getting walking, doing 150 minutes of vigorous exercise or slightly vigorous exercise per week is important, and a little bit of strength training 2 days per week, that will do more for your brain than pretty much anything else will do.
There's a lot of people this week, I would imagine, thinking of changing their careers. And even when you see the young crowd now, they don't seem to view that they're going to have one career for their whole lives, that they will do different things. I presume changing your job would be the ultimate...
Yes, changing your job would be a big shift to make. It doesn't have to be the only one, though, because that can be impractical for some people.
Yeah.
We need to think about our brains less as thinking machines and more as part of our bodies. So changing what you do with your physical body is the important thing. And this means looking after sleep, diet, activity. Now, part of that might be changing your job, but for many people, changing their job is shifting from one intellectual activity to another intellectual activity. And it would be much more efficient to make a physical change rather than a subtle mental one.
So everybody who's thinking of leaving their jobs this week, calm down, just go for a run or do something different. So 66, we go into another phase. What's happening in the brain then, and what does this phase look like?
What's happening in the brain then is the white matter is being depleted slightly. And what this means is the connections between different brain cells are starting to decline a little bit. And this is quite problematic if we simply let it happen without taking some steps to stop it. So as our brains become less connected up, we need to do things that optimize our functioning. And what this means is staying active. It means staying intellectually engaged. So after the age of 66 is a time when some people can withdraw a little bit from social life, but it's a time when it's needed more than ever. It is a time perhaps when people's eyesight or hearing can start to decline. And the message from this is very much, if that is the case, get the glasses, get the hearing aid and stay engaged. Don't be too upset by the apparent psychological capitulation to aging. What's far more important is you remain able to read, able to hear, able to see, and you remain engaged, reading the newspaper, reading things on the iPad, meeting people, meeting your family. Staying engaged is what matters, because the white matter, the connection, the axons, which are the sticky outy bits of the brain cells, they're starting to decline a little bit. So it is incredibly important to remain active and engaged after the age of 66.
And I presume physical health is more important than ever at that stage for brain health.
Yes, yes, it is. The physical activity, the blood pressure, if you've diabetes, managing that carefully, and also, you know, psychologically and mentally, staying connected is both physically good and, if you like, psychologically beneficial at this this phase of life.
So the next big phase starts at 83, if we're lucky enough to be still alive. Not as much data here, I know, but is decline is inevitable at this point, is it?
Well, no, change is inevitable at this point.
Change.
Decline can be managed a lot better than you might imagine. What's happened at this stage is your brain is now almost totally reliant on your habitual patterns from earlier in your life. It really struggles to establish new patterns at this point. It can do so, but the work you've done laying down a diversity of activities and interests will come into its own at the age of 83 and beyond. And you're right, they actually had very few brain scans for this period. But what it does show is that connection matters more than it ever did. In other words, talking with people, being in the company of other people can help, if you like, manage any decline that may be happening, as well as obviously looking after your physical health and watching out for your diet at that point.
OK, but you're also saying that the insurance policy we will have put in earlier stages of keeping a diverse and supple mind will stand to us at this point.
It absolutely will. A diverse range of activities and engagements. And of course, the second half of life is, according to many people, the more interesting one, in the sense that, you know, certainly Carl Jung argued the first part of life, you know, you're establishing relationships, maybe a family, maybe a career, and there's a certain formulaic aspect to it.
Yeah.
The second half, you have permission to look more inward, maybe to grow more as a person, and that this can be the most enriching and individuating part of life. So we don't want to give the message this is inevitable decline. This is a shift in gear and maybe a focus on things that matter more as life goes on, and particularly,
and maybe also caring less about yourself and making it and giving something back as well.
Absolutely. You know, it's less about personal achievement in the second half of life, because a lot of that has either happened or it hasn't happened. Whereas the second part can be more about giving towards other people, understanding yourself, individuating, and really coming to an understanding or an acceptance about what life has brought, rather than striving for things that probably don't matter so much in the end.
This is the Buddhists talking now, isn't it? And the Buddhists would often go away and live a worldly life for the first half, and then they became the monks in the second half when they'd done it all, didn't they?
But yes, but the second half of life in almost all spiritual and religious traditions is, you know, it can be quite different. We are very obsessed with our brains, particularly in the first part of life. And if you look at other traditions, say if you look at Sufi tradition in mystical Islam, where there is this emphasis on direct experience of the divine, unmediated by language. In other words, it's not all about the brain, that experiencing things in the physical body through movement, through sensory health is particularly useful concept in the later part of life. Sensory health means being aware of, you know, the senses of sight and touch and taste and feeling, and focusing on those, ensuring a diversity there, can enhance our function well into later life as
get
well.
Get a little bit beyond the rational kind of thing and go deeper there. I like it. Listen, there are lots of questions here. Somebody is asking about could you ask about the place of neurodiversity in this discussion of the stages of life? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Excellent question. The research we're talking about included, according to the words of the research paper, only neurotypical people. Now, this is a problem with the research, for sure. And what we know regarding neurodiversity is that our society in general and our education system has this incredibly rigid idea of what it is to be so-called neurotypical in the first part of life. And this serves nobody well at all. Often our education system forces us into a very rational, very cognitive way of approaching the world, whereas for those first 9 years, we need to also have irrational and sensory approaches to the world. So the increased awareness of neurodiversity should reshape our education system, particularly in the first 10 years, so that people have the full range of experience and we're not trying to put everyone into the same Procrustean mould, because everybody is different.
Is the idea of there being a neurotypical person, would you think, is that a bit of a myth, like?
Well, it always was a myth, for sure. And we've always tried to rather rigidly define and constrain people's function in the first part of life. So to answer the listener's question, neurodiversity hasn't been explored in this as much as one would like. But I think what this research says is that brain change is a constant, that there are patterns which are not absolute, and hopefully future research will give a little more credence or put a little more weight on studying people who identify as or are neurodiverse.
Okay. You think we teach kids to read too early, possibly, yeah? And block them into that.
There is a one-size-fits-all approach to education, which is partly necessary. And I know a lot of schools and teachers adapt curriculum very carefully to children's needs. But in other countries, there isn't such an emphasis early on reading. And, you know, people learn to read in the end anyway. And we do need, you know,
Most.
Maybe they could learn other things in those early years. The other limitation of this research, it's worth saying, is it put males and females in together. And we know that male and female brain development is quite different.
In what way?
Well, boys generally develop that little bit later than girls do. And there is a compelling argument out there that boys should start school a little bit later than girls do, because boys aren't quite as ready to benefit from the highly rational schooling that we often offer at the age when they start it. So maybe a little more nuance in that would be helpful.
I can see that you're kind of slightly nervous saying these things, because these are heretical things you're saying about stuff that's been there in operation for years that we do not think about changing at all. But actually, some of them are not fit for purpose anymore, no?
Yeah, I mean, there's a tension here. We need to have an education system that is reasonably uniform. But the fact is, it probably doesn't respond to the needs of individuals as much as it should, despite the very best efforts of teachers who are extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary people for whom I have endless admiration. And I come from a family of teachers. But one does worry that the education system is highly, highly rational and highly cognitive from too early a point, to the detriment of sensory learning and the extent to which we are embodied creatures with physical bodies and not just brains.
Texter says, as Homer Simpson reminds us, beer kills brain cells. Is that true?
Is
alcohol the kind of the variable in all this that can throw the brain right off?
Yeah, alcohol does impact on brain development for sure, as does cannabis use. So certain substances impact on brain development. Ideally, the World Health Organization has changed its advice recently. It says that the best amount of alcohol to drink is zero, and any more alcohol than that has the potential to affect mental health, and certainly it affects brain development. So that's particularly true in adolescence, which we now know appears to last from age 9 to age 32.
Okay, so what's the key takeaway, useful takeaway today?
Physical activity is the useful takeaway today. It's good for your brain. It's good for other parts of your body. And we are not just our brains. Our brain is an important part of us, but we got a whole lot of other stuff going on too.
And we are changing all the time.
We are always changing. So there is always the possibility for change, for growth, for renewal, right into your 90s and beyond.
I've come across this thing a few times recently. Are you aware of this end of history fallacy? Which is basically that, yes, I've changed a lot in my life, but now here I am, and this is who I am, and I'm not going to change anymore. And people always think, I've arrived, you know.
And, you know, we have never arrived. We are never going anywhere. We are always here. It is always now, and change is always possible. The idea of a fixed, completed self is an illusion. And yes, I am going to go quite Buddhist again on you, in the sense that we hold on to ideas about ourselves that are concrete, and the self is not concrete. We are constantly changing all of the time. And the boundaries...
I know what you're dying to say. You're dying to say, let go of that which does not serve you, aren't you?
I think we should let go of that which does not serve us, in answer to your question.
Listen, that was excellent. There were so many more questions, but I think we've got the picture there. Professor of Psychiatry and author Brendan Kelly, thank you so much for that. We'll take a break.